What's up there, good peoples? Cameron Northlake, Century 21, All Points Realty. And I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to hear what I've got to say. Today, we've got an excellent podcast episode. I was really looking forward to this interview. I'm still excited about it. This interview is with attorney Craig C. Fishbein. Attorney Fishbein and his clients are suing the governor of the state of Connecticut, that's Governor Ned Lamont, due to the executive orders that he set in place in which prevented Connecticut landlords from going through with the eviction process. So I understand that this is a controversial issue. I don't know which side of the aisle you sit on. I don't know if you are for landlords having the right to file evictions during COVID-19. I don't know if you're against it. Either way, I'm sure you'll be interested in what we are talking about here on today. So make sure that you listen to the entire episode because there's a lot of great information here. With that said, if you are not subscribed to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts at, if you're not subscribed, you definitely want to do that, okay? Because you really don't want to miss out. You really don't want to miss out on the great content that's going forth here on this podcast. So go ahead and hit that subscribe button. That way you'll be notified whenever I put out a new podcast episode. Also, if you're not following me on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, all of the above, you're missing out. I put out content that any investor or aspiring real estate investor could really benefit from anywhere in the state of Connecticut. I'm actually even pretty easy to find on Facebook. It's just Cameron Northfleet, the investor realtor. Instagram is at Cameron Northfleet, and YouTube is just Cameron Northfleet, or just type in youtube.com/ Cameron Northfleet. That's enough of that. I'm not going to prolong the time. We really want to get into this interview. I'm sure that you're looking forward to it. So without further ado, let's get into the interview. Craig Fishbein, how are you today?
Good. How are you doing, Cameron? Nice to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you. Outstanding. So, so tell us a little about yourself. Who are you? What do you do? And how did you get into it?
I'm an attorney. I've been an attorney for about 20 years. Got into it because my father was a lawyer and I was a lost child. I had dropped out of college. I was working in retail. Retail management. I didn't see a lot of progression. You know, I kept on going up through the chain, and but I started to stagnate, and I started to look for something different. And you know, my father, small practice, just him, a solo. And one of the things that I admired is, you know, no matter what problem I had, when I went to go see my father, he would drop everything that he did to talk to me about the problem. And I was like, wow, that must be a good job if you could just drop everything, you know?
Right.
And also, you know, lawyers I looked up to. I enjoy arguing, you know, based upon facts and law. I've always enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. So after dropping out of school and about 10 years working in retail, I went back to school and really didn't intend at that point to become a lawyer necessarily. I just wanted to get my degree, but I did really well and I got a scholarship to go to law school, and nice. Everything came together. And, you know, at first I tried to look for a job and couldn't find one out there. And my father finally said, well, why don't you come work with me? Because I had an interest in doing courtroom work because I clerked in the court for 3 years. I actually, when I decided to go back to school, I had a mortgage and, you know, we had bills to pay. So I worked full time and I went to school full time. And when I went to law school, I did the same thing. It was really tough, but I did well. And, you know, over the last 20 years or so, you know, I'm a civil litigator. So I'm in court just about every day on some case. And then I leave court, I go back to the office and I prepare for court the next day. So that's me, that's what I do, and that's sort of how I got there.
Cool. Awesome. What areas of law do you practice?
mostly family law, so divorces, child custody, that kind of stuff, and then civil rights. So the family stuff.
You're busy
stuff
these times.
Yes.
right.
Yeah. The family stuff is in state court, and most of the civil rights stuff is in federal court. So on the civil rights side, labor, standing up for people and their labor rights, standing up for, due process, equal protection, under our Constitution. Those are really right. Important fundamental rights to me. So that's most of what I do.
Nice. What would you say is the majority of what you do? Real estate, civil rights. What would you say makes the bulk of your work?
I do very little real estate. That's okay. Why my father and I, we work well, because he does wills, trusts, probate, real estate closings. Mm. And I don't do that stuff for the most part. I do the court stuff. So when somebody calls on the phone and they want a service, we're sort of like the all service firm, it's just who's going to do it.
Right.
In addition to being a lawyer, I'm also a politician. I'm okay. on my local town council. I've been on the Wallingford Town Council for over 10 years now.
Nice.
And I'm also a state representative up in Hartford. So right. I do hold both seats. And it keeps me very busy.
I bet it does. That's awesome. Do you invest in real estate as well, or not so much?
I do not. I will tell you that my wife and I have actively been looking into doing something like that, especially with, you see the downturn of real estate. But I have plenty of clients who are flippers, home improvement contractors, that are actively involved in real estate investment all over the state, quite frankly. So,
right. Well, if you want to get into real estate, I know a good real estate agent. So,
so do I. I think we're talking
here. Yeah, absolutely. So you are suing the governor of the state of Connecticut. Tell us about that.
Yes.
Well, not you're suing, not that you're suing, but you're representing people that are suing the state of the governor of the state of Connecticut. What's up with that?
Yeah. So it's not the first time that I've represented somebody suing the governor of the state of Connecticut. In fact, you might have seen a few weeks ago, I brought a different action under certain executive orders, and the judge has already ordered the governor to repeal an executive order based upon that lawsuit. So and that's progressing. But this new one has to do with landlords.
Right.
Small business owners that buy an investment property that want to rent, which is a legal occupation in our state, that have been impacted by two executive orders, Executive Order 7G and 7X. So what 7G basically says, the governor says that the courts really don't have to operate. And that's troubling to my clients because, we all know that there's the eviction process, right? Which is unfortunate. It's costly, but the process exists. When a landlord says to a prospective tenant, I'm going to allow you to use my property under this agreement, and I have certain responsibilities as the landlord, to keep the property safe and perhaps to remove the snow and all that stuff. And in exchange for your utilization of my property, you're going to pay me rent. That's an agreement. And when that agreement falls apart for whatever reason, the landlord has the legal right to regain possession of his property. Okay. So the governor, through Executive Order 7G, says, well, the courts don't have to operate. And what happens there is that some of my clients had already filed evictions. Mm-hmm. They had gone through the process. And the court, being closed in effect, is not allowing my clients to get back their property.
Right.
That's troublesome. Part of the Connecticut Constitution actually says that your courts shall be open to all persons for redress of any grievances.
Right.
So that's very troubling.
Absolutely.
With regard to 7G, 7X, which happened about a month later, directly referenced landlords. And what that did was generally four things. It said that a landlord cannot serve a notice to quit upon a tenant until at least July 1st at that time. A notice to quit is what starts the eviction process. The court doesn't know anything about a notice to quit. The landlord is saying you didn't observe some criteria in our agreement, and therefore I am asking you to give up possession of the property. And if the tenant doesn't vacate, then the next step of the process is a summary process eviction. Mm-hmm. And that's the next thing that Executive Order 7X addressed, where the governor said, even if you've done the notice to quit, and even if the tenant hasn't gotten out, you cannot now go to the next step and serve the summary process eviction. Right. So not so much the courts, because the courts don't know about this. The governor is saying you can't even access the process, which is troubling, because there's a concept which we hear about, but we don't talk a lot about. It's called due process.
Right.
And what that has to do is when government sets up a process in order for you to maintain or to regain your rights, and then government shuts down that process, there's a violation. It's a due process violation.
Right.
The other couple of things that Executive Order 7X had to do with was it said that a tenant doesn't have to pay the April rent on time. They get a forbearance of 60 days. Mm-hmm. The same thing with the May rent, forbearance of 60 days. And even if the contract says that the landlord can get a late fee, the governor said you can't charge the late fee. And part of the problem with those portions of the executive order is we have the contract clause of the Constitution. The contract clause says that government cannot step foot into private contract. So we have a lease, an agreement between two private parties, and government is saying, we're going to change the terms of this agreement. That's a violation of the contract clause.
Right.
The other portion of the executive order that is troubling to my clients is, you know, a lot of landlords, you know, landlords provide a vital service, right? They provide housing to individuals that either don't want to purchase or perhaps can't purchase a property because of, let's say, credit reasons. And the law allows a landlord to receive at the time of occupancy a security deposit of 2 months for somebody who's 65 and younger. And a lot of landlords do that because of the credit situation.
Right.
And what Executive Order 7X said with regard to that was that the tenant can direct the landlord to apply a portion of that security deposit towards the April, May, or June rent. And the problem there is our Constitution, the concept, before I get to what the Constitution says, is a takings. Our Constitution says that your property shall not be taken from you by the government without just compensation. So when a landlord has a security interest of 2 months during through private contract, and government steps in and says, we are going to order you to reduce your security interest, that is a taking. It's a constitutional violation. So, you know, generally those are the concepts by which or under which this case is brought. I'll tell you procedurally where we are. We had a meeting with the judge last Friday by Zoom. We have filed very lengthy documents. We filed a complaint. We filed a preliminary injunction, motion for preliminary injunction. I think those two documents total right around 100 pages.
No.
The judge ordered the governor's lawyers to respond to that by, I believe it's July 11. We have a week to respond to that, July 17. And then we're supposed to have a hearing on July 22nd, where the judge will take evidence and hear us argue why he should issue a preliminary injunction on behalf of our client.
Right. Awesome. Okay. So you just said some deadlines as far. So basically we should be hearing something as the general public by around, July 22nd, or there shortly thereafter, we should probably hear something as far as the progress of this case.
Well, the hearing will happen on that day. On a preliminary injunction motion, judges are usually quite quick to render a decision. In the case that I just had against the governor, the judge took a week to, he wrote a 26-page decision laying out, these are the facts, this is the law, this is how I apply the law to the facts, and this is my ruling. And that's what judges do. It's called a memorandum of decision.
Gotcha.
And that's what we would expect here. It's a complex case. There's a lot of issues. But it's an important case too. A lot of people have been clamoring, a lot of landlords have been clamoring, for some relief here. So,
right. Do you see it happening that quickly, or do you think that this might be something that might be fought out, you know, a long battle in court, a lengthy battle? How do you see this playing out?
Well, I do foresee at the other end a somewhat lengthy battle. And let me just explain that when you file a motion, motion is asking a court to do something before the final resolution of the case, okay? And filing for a preliminary injunction, you have to prove certain things to the court to get the court to act. And it's rare, actually, that the court will act that quickly on something like that. And one of those things is you have to prove that it's more than likely that you will succeed in your case. And that's why in the other one, the judge made that finding. You know, it's sort of a mini trial. Most cases do settle after a hearing on a preliminary injunction because you've presented most of your evidence, right? You know, in this case, just so that you know, we did also sue the governor in his official as well as his individual capacity. And I just want to explain that for a moment. So a government official who gets sued in their official capacity, whatever judgment, whatever remedy is paid for by the taxpayers, okay? The government official has indemnification for personal liability. And the concept there is that they're acting within the scope of their job, their election and all of that stuff. Right. But in this case, we've alleged that the governor has done things that he doesn't have the power to do. And the legal concept is, it's Latin, it's ultra vires, and it means without authority. And when you allege that a elected official acted outside of their authority, then you have to sue them in their individual capacity also, because you're alleging they did it without their authority, without the authority. That's a whole nother concept here. I had a similar case a few years ago against the city of Meriden, where the corporation council and a few board members were appointed by the city. And I brought a legal action on behalf of some people alleging that they were not appointed with authority. And ultimately we went to the Connecticut Supreme Court on that issue, and the court agreed with me. And they were all removed from office. So those cases are rare. It's rare that you'll find a lawyer who's willing to do that stuff, quite frankly.
Right.
But I have been down this road before.
Okay. So now what are you looking for as far as compensation or damages? What are you looking for from the state? What are you looking for from the governor himself? Or what are you asking for, I should say? Or what are you demanding?
Yes. In our papers, we did not make a specific demand. A lot of times you are able, through what is known as discovery. Discovery is the collection of documents and testimony by a deposition and that kind of stuff. You're more able to ascertain what your numbers would be. These are, almost all of them are what are known as federal 1983 violations. They are federal civil rights violations. And you really don't have to have specific damages in order to claim damages in a civil rights action. You know, if you have a lot of talk about police these days, but let's say police officer does something bad, right, and, you know, beat somebody up. Okay.
Right.
Horrible, horrible situation. You know, the person has out-of-pocket expenses, right? Medical bills, that kind of stuff. Those are what are known as economic damages. They're out because of the bad act. The other portion of that, the violation of civil rights, the pain and suffering, is really not quantifiable, right? Mm. So there's many different components that go into that. That analysis. So we have not made a demand.
Is that to be determined? Like,
yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Absolutely. You know, because one of the components is, as I mentioned, the late fee, right? So now if I've got, you know, a landlord who got the rent late, but they couldn't charge the late fee because of the executive order, that's a component of economic damages, right?
Right.
But the stepping into private contract, that civil rights violation, doesn't have that same mathematical computation.
Right.
That's the only way I can put that together.
I understand.
In the in that other case that I was talking about, the state did come to us and say, well, what is your demand? And my response was, we haven't done discovery. What is your offer?
I like it. Right. Awesome.
So, awesome. Fun stuff. Every day is different.
Yeah. So it sounds like fun. Okay. Now, first, let me ask you this. Is this the only case like this in the state of Connecticut, like at this time, or do you know of any others?
I know. Well, there is no other case dealing with landlords in the state. I know there's one case in state court that has to do, it's really challenging the determination of essential and non-essential businesses. I think that case is generally stalled. I don't see any activity going on in that case at all. There's three other federal cases. One case was brought in New Haven. I think it's Club 51 is the plaintiff. And what they're claiming in that case is that the governor's order against congregation of persons in excess of 50, that violated their constitutional right to run a business. They also sued Mayor Elliker in that case. They did have a hearing on preliminary relief, like we've been talking about, and they did lose that motion. The judge found that they did not prove their case sufficient to get the relief. There's another case, another federal court case, that challenges the orders having to do with masks. That, too, has really not gone anywhere. And the only other one that I know about is brought by the Libertarian Party, having to do with ballot access for the November election, and that they can't comply with the current rules based upon COVID in order to get ballot access that they ordinarily would. And I think that case is also stalled. So of all of these cases that have been filed, I have the one that we got, we were successful in getting the order out of that we're actively working on. And I have this landlord case now. Those are the two most viable cases that I'm aware of in the state of Connecticut. We, in preparation for both of these cases, we did review every case in the country, I believe, that has been filed regarding gubernatorial executive orders. And I think comparing where we are to where they are, we are doing exceptionally well. I know that there we got national coverage on our last case all over the country. In fact, I had an acquaintance in California contact me, a couple out of Washington, D.C., because it's rare that you get an order by the federal court that a state governor must do something. An interesting case out of Kentucky, actually, it's the On Fire Christian Academy case. Happened, the decision came down the day before Easter, and it had to do with religious services. And in fact, I'm going to send you a copy of that decision because I think you'll find it to be amazing. I've dared each person that I've sent that to not hum the national anthem or God Bless America during the decision, because you know it's just dripping with references to Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Paine, and this isn't the government that we grew up with, and right. It's just an amazing decision. But anyway, the judge in that case allowed the church to have a service on Easter. In Kentucky, and I actually watched that on Facebook that morning. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, please do share that, and I'll also when you send it, I'll add it in the show notes so everybody can see that. If we have like a link or something like that, that'd be great. So let me ask you this: how could someone, John Public or whatever, how could we follow this case? Is there any way that we can follow along with what's going on with this case?
Yeah, the federal court has a system. It's called PACER, P-A-C-E-R, like the basketball team. And anybody can sign up to get access to PACER. And you would look up the case in there, and it's Oracle Homes. Oracle is spelled A-U-R-A-C-L-E, Homes, LLC. Versus Lamont, and you'll see a bunch of hyperlinks and a bunch of documents.
Awesome.
And anybody can see what's going on, and that's how you would do that.
Cool. All right, so for those landlords that are not directly involved in your case, so those that are not your clients, is there any would we benefit from this case at all whatsoever?
Absolutely, in that we have not filed for class action status. That's sometimes what happens in these cases, but what we've said is that our clients and those that are similarly situated, which would be you,
right,
and every other landlord, are being impacted by these executive orders. So yes, I think every landlord, assuming that we are successful, assuming that we get a good decision, all of that stuff, every landlord would benefit from this case.
Right. Cool.
And just, there was one distinction I just want to bring up. This only has to do with residential landlords, and it's an interesting equal protection thing. That's a concept that we didn't talk about too much. Equal protection says that there are different classes and they are held to the same standard. Well, the executive order 7X that had to do with whether or not you could serve the notice to quit, it only has to do with dwelling units. So therefore the governor said it's okay to do a notice to quit for a commercial property but not for a residential property. Now if the intent was COVID related, right? Why? Mm. It doesn't make sense. If you're looking to, you know, cut down on the utilization of the courts, why? It doesn't make sense. That's the equal protection argument. And I think it's a good one.
Okay, so what remedies do landlords have that as far as like collecting their late fees and all that stuff? Is there anything that your average landlord can do? Should they bring their own lawsuit? You know, let's say they've had a tenant that hasn't paid and they've lost money, you know, to this point. Is there anything that they can do to recoup those funds from the state of Connecticut?
Not presently. I mean, so I guess the root question is landlord wasn't paid. They were paid late. They're out, let's say, $8 for that month's late fees. Can they sue the state for that? On its face, no. They would have to challenge the order itself, as we have here.
So they'd have to bring their own lawsuit.
Yeah. Gotcha. That would be the situation, yes.
Gotcha. So how do you think the governor should, I know you are a politician. How would you say that the governor should have handled this situation?
Oh, well, you know, we could go on for days about that, you know.
For sure.
Part of the problem with the executive orders themselves is the legislature had no input on that, right? So ordinarily, if the governor was thinking about doing something like this, he would submit a bill, you know, a proposed law. It would go to the housing committee. The housing committee would have a public hearing where landlords and tenants can come and say, you know, this is why this is good, this is why this is bad, you know, all of that stuff. There may be modifications to the governor's language. And then a law is legally passed, right?
Right.
That should have been the process.
Gotcha.
You know, the governor, since March 10th, since he, you know, issued his declarations of public health and civil preparedness emergencies, has basically shut out the legislature from the process. There's been problems with a lot of executive orders. One of his very first executive orders, he had to change 2 days later because his own staff brought to his attention that it was unconstitutional. you know, and that's what we did in that other case that I was talking about. I had to get a federal court judge to say, Governor, what you're doing is unconstitutional and you have to repeal it.
Right.
And until somebody challenges these things in court, it stands. You know, so there's a lot of complaints about the executive orders. You know, perhaps the governor could have recommended that landlords do something like this, right? That's probably what I would have done. I've got two people that have entered into a private contract that are, you know, living harmoniously for the most part, and I've got an idea how they should act within the COVID, you know, I recommend, right?
Right.
But not go to the draconian measure of ordering you must, right? So in my opinion, those are ways that the governor could have done this better and differently.
Do you feel that tenants should have some sort of protection at all whatsoever with this whole COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, it's a very general question, and I think the general answer is yes, without specificity. So it really depends on what that looks like. You know, part of this whole situation, a lot of people are out of work, right? When government puts people out of work, a ball starts rolling downhill, and government has to create other orders to, like, massage and to fix the problems that it created. And one of the fixes is, quite frankly, the federal government stepped in and said, we're going to give everybody who's applying for unemployment $600 more, right, per week. And that is a laudable action by the federal government. However, the government didn't say, you can't go spend it on beer and cigarettes, right?
Right, right.
The government could have said, we're going to give you the $600 if you're going to apply that towards your housing.
Gotcha.
But they didn't. So, yes, protections necessary. But, you know, some of our clients have complained to us because, you know, the government is paying for these people. And yet, you know, you got the money coming in the door. And then the government says you don't have to pay your obligations to your landlord. It's counterintuitive.
Mm.
You know, right. The other problem is, I don't think all of the tenants understand that the rent is forbeared for 60 days.
Yes.
Some think they don't have to pay rent at all.
Right. Right. Right.
So now you've got the courts closed. You're going to have people in the next 30 days or so who are going to realize that that money that they spent on something else, they should have saved for rent or paid their rent. They can't do that now. Evictions are now open, and you are going to have a flood of evictions, housing crisis, all of that stuff. Problems created by the government.
Right.
Stepping into private contract.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, probably the greatest protection for the tenants here would have been for government not to get involved in the first place.
Understood. Understood for sure. Wow. Awesome. So, listen, I'm with you. I'm with you 100%. You know, I agree with you, and I wish you success. It is a sticky subject, because I do believe that, you know, there are those landlords out there that, you know, probably would have evicted someone on the second of the month if the state would allow them to do so. You know what I mean? So, but at the same time, you know, like you said, I have a contract with my tenant, you know, so who are you to come in and tell me that, that we cannot abide by what we agreed to abide by? You know what I mean? So, so I agree with you 100% on that. And I thank you for doing what you're doing, for sure. Hopefully that this provides some sort of case law so that this wouldn't happen, you know, in the future. So if someone wanted to know more about you, or if they want to hire you for your services, how would they go about contacting you?
My office is in Wallingford. It's Fishbein Law Firm. My telephone number is 203-265-2895. I'm also, my email address is ccf@fishbeinlaw, and that's fishbeinlaw.com.
Awesome. Well, listen, I definitely thank you for taking the time to speak to me. I wish you the best in your in this court case and your other court cases, unless you sue me. But I definitely wish you the best with all this. And again, I thank you for taking the time to speak to us. Do you have anything else that you want to say before we go?
No, sir. I mean, I enjoy listening to your podcasts, and I find them to be very informative. It's an area that not a lot of people know about, and I appreciate, because you provide a public service, right?
Right.
And I appreciate it. So thank you for having me, and have a good day.
Thank you very much. You have a good day as well. For everyone else out there, as always, thank you for your time and make it a great day.